So in a perfect world, all children would grow up with their own married parents. But we don't live in a perfect world, and we know that there are marriages and relationships that are so destructive that divorce or separation might well be the best of the available options for everyone involved. For the purposes of this study, we looked at what we could achieve if we had a serious but realistic reduction in family breakdown, if we could reduce it by half. The American study similar to this one by Scafidi that Andrea just mentioned, by comparison, bases its calculations upon all family breakdown being repaired and prevented. We've chosen to base our work on a modest but still significant reduction, emphasizing not what would happen in a theoretical perfect world, but what we could see in our lifetimes if we reversed trends in family formation and breakdown without setting our sights impossibly high. When it comes to underestimating costs, none of these countries were as conservative as we have been in our assessment here. The American and British studies included foregone tax income caused by single families in poverty, which were net recipients of services, who would be lifted out of poverty and become net contributors in an intact family. We haven't included tax revenues in our estimates either of the costs of family breakdown today or in potential boosted income due to stronger families in the future. The other three studies all included, to some degree, assessments of the higher costs to civil society and social services beyond poverty alleviation. For example, in terms of education, we know that children from broken homes need more staff and special programming to cope with the behavioral problems that are more frequent. For the healthcare system, we know that the poorer mental and physical health that characterizes children from single-parent families impose higher costs on the healthcare system. And the justice system itself bears a lot of costs, first more directly through the court time involved in processing divorces and in the legal proceedings that stem from issues of child custody and investigating abuse or neglect and the collection and enforcement of child support, and more directly also by policing and justice costs that are increased with the higher likelihood of criminal involvement in children who grow up in a broken family. We also don't evaluate the economic costs of underemployment and poorer educational outcomes for children from broken families when they themselves reach adulthood. In other words, we've included only the most direct costs of programs that alleviate poverty for children for families with children today. The foundation of our methodology is the Canadian study that Andrea mentioned by Finney and Sweetman. This is based on tax returns filed over a series of years for a number of families, which tracked changes in their income and poverty status, as well as changes from one category of household to another. Now, we move from one category to another of census family all the time. Two singles who get married are moving to a different category. A young adult who moves out for the first time is moving from being part of a family with dependents to being a single without dependent family. If they're the last child to leave home, then when they move out, their parents also become a family, a childless couple for tax purposes. Divorce or death transforms a couple into either a single household or a single parent household, depending on whether they have children. And since census and revenue data rarely distinguish in Canada between legally married couples or those who are cohabiting, the birth of a couple to a cohabiting couple, to a cohabiting couple, or the breakup of a common law union also move people from one category of household to another. So this study that correlates changes in family status with changes in income, and which is based on data drawn from throughout the 90s, shows that becoming a single parent greatly increases poverty. This is true whether the single parenthood is a result of a breakdown in a two-parent household or whether it is the result of a single person becoming a parent. Similarly, moving out of single parenthood lifts more than half of single parent households out of poverty. Becoming part of a couple instead of a single parent makes it easier to stop being poor, in other words. And by the same token, remaining in a couple rather than suffering a family breakdown and becoming a single parent helps prevent becoming poor. The reasons for this range from fairly straightforward to complex. At the most basic level, a two-parent household has two adults capable of earning a wage and taking care of children. So the potential income of a two-parent household is fundamentally higher than for a single-parent household. Beyond that, though, economies of scale mean that a two-parent family with two children, for instance, spends less on shelter, food, and utilities than a single parent with two children plus another single living separately. At a deeper level, having two adults in a family allows for a degree of specialization. One partner can provide a greater share of the child care for small children, while the other brings home a larger share of the household income, according to their particular earning potential, temperament, and other circumstances. And harder to quantify still, but demonstrated in studies around the world, is the effect that being part of a couple, and usually being married, has on the partners involved. Controlling for other variables, married men in particular earn more money than single men with equivalent education and backgrounds. In estimating the savings that would result from having family breakdown, we use the study by Finney and Sweetman showing that, of poor single parents who become part of intact families, 54.8% would be lifted out of poverty from that transition. For the sake of simplicity, as well as our inherently cautious approach, we've rounded down and we use 50% instead of 54.8. So we estimate that half of families making the transition from single-parent families to two-parent families would no longer be poor. We then divided total poverty alleviation spending caused by family breakdown by two again, to reflect a halving of the number of broken families, and then halving it to reflect the number of these newly intact families that would no longer be poor. Again, this is based on our conservative approach and our understanding that we don't live in a perfect world, as well as the fact that if a lone parent enters a two-parent family, their odds of ceasing to be poor are higher, but not 100%. And this is how we identify the total potential savings of reducing family breakdown. This slide shows the means-tested poverty relief programs in each province that are included in this study. This is also on page 47 and 48 of the printed report. In each province, we examined programs for the fiscal year 2005-2006 that were designed to provide or supplement income, housing, childcare, and health-related costs that were means-tested. In other words, that were designed to relieve the effects of poverty. Not all government transfers are means-tested. The current universal child care benefit is an example of this, since it's based on family status, having a preschool child in the family, without regard to family type or income. Based on provincial reports, documentation, and correspondence with representatives of the programs involved in each province, we calculated the fraction of total expenditures in each program going to broken families. We identified all relevant programs, determined their yearly expenditures, selected the appropriate multiplier based upon the target population that they served and what proportion of that population was in a broken family, and then added all this up for all 10 provinces to obtain our figure of almost $7 billion per year. Applying our estimate that half of newly intact families would be lifted out of poverty, and basing our calculations upon the goal of having family breakdown, we found that the potential savings to the Canadian taxpayer if family breakdown were cut into to be $1.7 billion a year. There's every reason to think that in reality, the figure is much higher. There are many costs that we couldn't include in this study, and many more that we chose to omit because they were indirect or hard to quantify. We excluded, for instance, programs such as child support enforcement, shelters for abused women and children, mediation programs designed to help divorcing parents share custody without conflict, and the foster care system, the vast majority of whose users are in broken families. We didn't omit these costs because they're insignificant or unrelated to family breakdown. In fact, I'd argue these are the expenses that are most directly linked to family breakdown, but because accounting for their costs is not easy given the information currently available. Similarly, this study examines only the direct financial costs of family breakdown, not the indirect costs, such as the extra healthcare, education, and justice system costs, or the costs other than financial, such as the greater rates of depression and higher levels of stress for adults and children following a family breakdown. We also didn't consider costs which we know to exist but can't quantify accurately. This includes much of the social program spending that goes to Aboriginals across Canada that has the effect of mitigating the financial consequences of family breakdown, programs for at-risk youth that are disproportionately used by children of single-parent families, the court costs of divorce proceedings, and many more. While there is clear evidence that urban Aboriginals are significantly more likely to be poor, and that family breakdown is a pervasive problem in the Aboriginal community both on and off reserve, there are some fundamental differences that make the model we use less adaptable to studying the link between family breakdown and poverty for Aboriginal families. Not least of these issues is that the administration of many programs aimed at Aboriginals is federal or at the Band Council level, whereas all the programs we looked at are provincial, as well as the fact that a number of benefits for Aboriginals are not means-tested, but rather entitlements due to treaties and court decisions, and so they're not, strictly speaking, poverty alleviation policy. This chart shows the amount of money each province would save if family breakdown there were halved and intact families were lifted out of poverty by reversing or avoiding family breakdown by area of program spending. This is also on page 20 of your printed report. One thing we observe here is that the differences between poverty levels in single and two-parent families varies according to the level of prosperity enjoyed by the province in general. In Alberta, for instance, employment in 2005-2006 was very low, while housing costs were extremely high. The cost of living was therefore much higher, and the difference in earning potentials for households with two working-age members and those with only one is also accordingly greater. By contrast, in much of the Maritimes, where the economy is less robust and unemployment and poverty more common in all family forms, the background level of dependence upon government is higher, and the difference that family status makes in a given household's risk of poverty is therefore somewhat attenuated. Similarly, in Quebec, the public sector is larger than in other provinces, and means-tested benefits are often replaced by universal benefits. The clearest example of this is the $7 a day daycare program. In a society in which reliance upon government transfers is not as closely linked to poverty, in other words, when the state assumes a larger role in the lives of all families, well-off or struggling, then family breakdown does not produce greater dependence to the same degree that it does in a society where the normal rate of dependence on government is lower. If each province saw a 50% reduction in the number of broken families, and if this correspondingly led to a 50% reduction in the need for assistance for those families lifted out of poverty, each province would be able to shrink its spending by a measurable amount, in some cases a very large amount. Tied to this reduction in welfare spending is a decrease in the number of people depending upon welfare for the necessities of life and subject to the other ills associated with chronic welfare dependency. Each number represents, therefore, not only fiscal savings, but also better lives for substantial numbers of adults and children, as shown here. In short, a bare minimum of savings that could be accrued would be close to $2 billion annually. This would also mean close to 50,000 adults and over 80,000 children who would no longer need to be on welfare. Stable families also make a contribution to social capital. This is harder to measure, but intuitively we can understand that stable families enhance the underlying sense of community and trust that makes neighborhoods safer, strangers friendlier, and civic life richer and more resilient. Social capital is generated largely by healthy families. Fathers fill a crucial role in their own families, but beyond that, they also serve as male role models for their children's friends and in a more general sense. So, too, does the chronic lack of fathers harm not just a specific family missing a father, but also the wider society. Neighborhoods in which fathers are scarce contribute to a culture of machismo, violence, and irresponsibility for young men, and this harms even those children who do live with both their parents. A recent documentary on Global TV called Shattered Dreams focused on a Toronto area where gun violence was rampant and interviewed single mothers. These mothers talked about not being able to cope with their sons, and the boys, in turn, who were interviewed, lived long distances from their fathers and saw them only occasionally and sometimes only spoke with them sporadically by phone. Simple things, too, like participation in parent advisory councils and neighborhood associations, or involvement in local politics and community causes, are all higher when more families are intact, in part because adults and two-parent families have the time to get involved, and all of these, too, build social capital. But the fiscal costs aren't negligible. Nationally, the direct taxpayer costs of poverty alleviation for broken single-parent families would be reduced by at least $1.7 billion annually if we could cut family breakdown in two. For an average Canadian family, this corresponds to a decrease of almost $1,000 per household per year in public spending. This is a conservative estimate, but it's still a consequential sum of money. It represents, for instance, a tenth of our annual military budget. It's also a tenth of the projected cost of our mission in Afghanistan from its inception up until 2011. $1.7 billion is also the most recent estimate of the budget for the 2010 Vancouver Olympics, which we all recognize as a one-time expenditure that we couldn't afford on a regular basis. This report is largely focused on providing factual information to help Canadians make healthy choices in their private lives. Family breakdown extracts private, public, cultural, and fiscal costs, and stronger families confer benefits in each of these areas as well. Our recommendations, therefore, reflect all spheres of life. We believe we should include marriage education at the high school level, so students are equipped to make major life choices with the best evidence available about what makes a stable, happy, and healthy family. We currently educate teens about the psychological and physical implications of sexual activity, drug use, and bullying, because we recognize that these are complex problems that can cause great harm, and that kids can't make healthy choices if they don't have good information. We need to place equal importance on family formation throughout our culture, and educating the next generation is a great place to start this. We should include information on the public benefits of marriage and the drawbacks of divorce in premarital and marital counseling. Conferring special status on married couples has always been society's way of recognizing the contribution that stable families make to the public good. It's time to state explicitly how strong families benefit their members as well as the wider society. We should consider introducing family taxation, a system which allows couples to file taxes jointly, thereby decreasing their tax burden. This attaches a financial incentive to maintaining a healthy family, and also makes it easier for couples to make choices about work, childcare, and the division of responsibilities that best meets their own needs and those of their children. We should improve the manner in which provinces account for social spending. Annual reports for ministries that provide social services should indicate what proportion of their users are married, cohabiting, or single parents. We can't fully grasp the damage done by family breakdown if we don't keep track of the degree to which different kinds of households and families are dependent on income and other assistance. We should introduce better and more accurate tracking of marriage versus common law relationships in statistics. Every jurisdiction that has done this has found important differences between these two types of families, with respect not just to finances, but also to stability, risk of abuse, and risk of breakdown. Finally, we should ensure that government and policymakers understand the difference between marriage and cohabitation, and choose to promote marriage for all the benefits it offers over cohabitation. Marriage isn't the same thing as cohabitation, and the benefits and credits we provide to married couples should be reserved for them, and not extended to cohabiting couples, nor should private groups be prevented from recognizing the distinction between marriage and cohabitation.